on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur, because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. I hope you're having a great day, a great wrap of the summer here as we get closer and closer to September. I hope things are going well for you. We have a fantastic show for you today, a real great one, and I appreciate you listening. First up, we have Amy Jacobson. We're going to talk about emotional intelligence with her. It's so important. I love the stat, you cannot get smarter, but you can become more emotionally intelligent. For every point that your EI goes up, you should make another $1,600 a year. I like that because I can't change how smart I am, but I can become more emotionally intelligent. So it's just an encouraging story. And Amy is absolutely fantastic. You will love her. After that, Scott Turow is with us, has written, 14 bestsellers, I think. And many movies have been made from his stuff. I think Presumed Innocent was his breakthrough. That was the Harrison Ford movie where Harrison Ford was a lawyer and accused of killing his mistress, and he had the really bad haircut. That's the way I remember that movie. It was Harrison Ford looking at his absolute worst because of the haircut. Anyway, fantastic to have Scott with us. It is part of our greatest hits. We lost a server, and so we are rebuilding. And I want to have these greatest hits available to you. And so that is what we are doing with Scott. Please go buy my book. I have a new book out called The Real Environmentalist, arguing that entrepreneurs like you are going to save the earth from environmental issues. Very upbeat, positive book. I hope you go check it out because you will love it. Thanks for being with us. And we're going to get started in just a second.
Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalist. Thank you.
We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. You know, so many factors determine whether we're successful or not, how intelligent we are, how hard we work. But one of the factors that we don't talk about enough is our emotional intelligence. Maybe you don't even know what that is, but luckily we have someone who's going to help us. Please welcome Amy Jacobson. She is an emotional intelligence and human behavior specialist. She has delivered programs and keynotes all across Australia and internationally, published twice by Wiley. You don't really get any more prestigious than that. Her newest book is called The Emotional Intelligence Advantage, Mastering Change in Difficult Conversations. Amy, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for having me, Jim.
It is my pleasure. Let's start off, for those who don't know, what is emotional intelligence? Why is it important?
The easiest way for me to explain is to compare it to IQ, right, which majority of people know. So your IQ is what you know and what you can do. Your emotional intelligence is how and why you do it. So it's really understanding, you know, what is it? What is the wiring within me? What's driving the decisions? What's driving the communication? How well do I control my emotions? And what is the impact that I have on the people around me?
All right. And I remember one cool fact that if you increase your emotional intelligence by one point, your income goes up almost $1,000.
There is some incredible statistics that are coming out now, and we're really starting to see a change in the workplace, just the big difference that the emotional intelligence actually has. And I like to say, Jim, that, you know, your IQ will get your foot in the door. That will get you that will land you your job. But your emotional intelligence is what gets you promoted. So we are starting to notice that those people that do display higher levels of emotional intelligence tend to be your people that are getting promoted. They're also your high performers. So your high performers, majority of your high performers actually show up with higher levels of emotional intelligence as well. So to really get anywhere in your career, your IQ is only going to take you so far. You need that point where your emotional intelligence kicks in. And that's the way in which you interact with people. It's the how, it's the why you do what you do.
All right. Can we go through the various pieces, perhaps? There's a lot of different parts of emotional intelligence.
There is. Let's start with that. Really, when we look at emotional intelligence, it is a five-part methodology. And we know that emotional intelligence has been around for as long as human beings have been around. And probably one of the most well-known definitions out there is your self-awareness, your self-regulation, your empathy, your social skills, your communication, and your motivation. Jim, I like to really simplify it into language we use on a day-to-day basis and also make it really relatable to the workplace. So we're looking at own it, face it, feel it, ask it, and drive it. And what those five steps are is that your first step around own it is your self-awareness, but it's so much more than that as well. It's about owning who you are, owning the decisions that you've made in your life that have got you to where you are today, owning those values and beliefs that are actually driving those decisions as well, but also owning the reality of the situation. And the reality is that we are going to be in situations in life that we have no control over. So you've got to own the fact that this is happening, whether I like it or not, this is happening. So that's first step around own it, is really taking the responsibility and understanding the role that we are playing in the situation. Now, your second step is your face it, and your face it is when we're going to face all of the emotions that are coming up. So once we're really starting to recognize something or own a situation, or even just be confronted with a situation, we are always feeling emotions. Those emotions are going to start to bubble up. And every single one of those emotions, we are feeling for a reason. So we've got to face them. We've got to face them and understand where are they coming from, what's driving them, and how do we actually acknowledge them and process them? How do we get comfortable with the feelings that are happening? I like to say you've got to face the emotion, but don't unpack your bags and stay there. So know how to face it, but then process it and move it on. And these first two steps are very much in our own head. So it's about us. We're looking internally. It's at your third step that we get out of your own head. So this is when we start to look around and we understand how the people around us are feeling. So that feel it is around empathy. It's around empowerment, around all of those skills that make us great leaders. And when I say leaders, I mean based on the skill set, not by the job title. So anything that helps us to understand what makes other people tick and why they are wired different and their priorities and their values and beliefs that are guiding that, that's in your feel it area. So it's understanding it's not about us, it's how the people around us are feeling. Then the fourth step is ask it, and ask it is communication. But it's called ask it because it's at this point that we ask the right questions. But more importantly, we answer the questions that are being asked of us. So knowing that communication is two-way and emotional intelligence has a huge influence on our communication. So knowing the right words to use based on the emotional undertones, knowing how to communicate with somebody and knowing that communication is passing a message from one person to another. And if that person doesn't comprehend or understand that message, then the communication has failed. And that's not on them, that's on us. So that's your fourth step around ask it. And then your final step is your fifth step is drive it. And drive it is your action step. This is where we bring it all together. So this is your motivation. This is your doing step. And it's at a drive it where we take it all and we go, okay, what are the actions out of this? What is it that we actually need to do to move forward? And in this area too, this is about understanding the way in which the brain is actually wired so you can work with it rather than against it. It's that whole thing of working smart, not harder. So that's your five parts of emotional intelligence, and they're actually a process as well. So it's a process that we all go through on many times a day, but we all go through it on different speeds. Is that own it, face it, feel it, ask it, and drive it.
All right. Very, very good synopsis, Amy. Thank you. So now that we understand this, how can I get better? How can I improve my emotional intelligence?
You gotta start with yourself. So all everything to do with emotional intelligence, you have to start internally. And I would say your best thing to do is to hit pause for a moment. We are moving so fast in this world at the moment, and we are looking for the next shiny object, the next thing, the, you know, how do we progress further? How do we become more successful? And I would suggest just hitting the pause button for a moment and truly understanding what makes you tick, understanding why you're chasing that goal, understanding what your enoughness is, understanding, you know, what the definition of success is in your mind and what's actually driving it. Because until we really know what those values and those beliefs are and how we've defined success and how we've defined happiness, it makes it very hard to understand what those next steps should actually be. So hit pause, look internally, and start to understand yourself, understand what your values and beliefs are and what that wiring is actually happening and how you've defined success in your mind.
And it can be success, not necessarily financial success, but emotional success, right? Happiness.
That's, do you know what? When it comes down to it, when you really start to do the work, you realize that success is, as corny as it sounds, success is happiness. And I'm sure we've all met people in this world that have all of the materialistic things. They have the, you know, the amazing businesses. They have the job title, the pay packet, the house, the car, the boat, the investment portfolio. But some of those people are not necessarily happy. Yet you can meet some people in this world that have very little and can be some of the happiest people you meet. So really when you start to do the work, you realize that success is a measure of happiness. And if your definition of success is around something that is financial or materialistic, will it ever be enough? Or are you just going to reach that goal and then change the goal and make it that little bit harder? And at what point will you actually stop striving for that future you and actually live and enjoy the current you?
In the book, you talk about how you can use emotional intelligence to disrupt certain mindsets. And it's a little bit like the list you just went through, own it, face it, feel it, ask, drive it. But could you go back through and talk about the mindsets that we're trying to get rid of there?
Yeah, so the key mindsets we're trying to break through is that fear and defensive mechanism. And this mindset comes up anytime that change is introduced or anytime that a difficult conversation is on the table. And the reason being is that we know that our mind is filled with billions of neural pathways, and these neural pathways have been created based on our experiences and throughout our life. And for each neural pathway, there is a trigger or something that occurs that actually kicks off that neural pathway, and then we follow that pathway, and at the end of the pathway is how we respond to it. So when we are faced, especially when it comes to business, right, when we come across things that such as change or difficult conversations or things that we're not prepared for, what we tend to do is this wiring in our mind, it kind of sets off alarm bells or red flags and says, hang on a minute, something isn't right here. I've got this embedded pathway that's telling me that this is how it happens and this is what the path we follow and this is how I emotionally respond. So when these pathways, when we're presented in situations where these pathways aren't aligned, that's when our emotional brain, our amygdala, kind of goes into that emotional hijack. And a lot of people will know that as the fight or flight, right? So this fight or flight kicks off. And at that point in time, it's your emotional intelligence that you've got to leverage in order to balance out that fight or flight. Because if we are in that fight or flight situation, it's fear that's driving it. Our mindset will naturally try to protect us against that fear, against the fear actually coming to fruition or happening. So what it does is it puts up these barriers to try and say, no, this is not happening. And this protection mechanism kicks in, which is quite often defensive, which means that in situations like change, in situations like difficult conversations, in any situation that is unexpected, we tend to default into that defensive mechanism. And emotional intelligence is looking to break through that defense mechanism, to get that real curiosity, to get the understanding, to know that the role that you're playing in it. So that's what we look at, that owner is being able to look and either own the fact that you have no control over the situation and it's happening regardless. So how are you going to approach it? But also owning the fact that the only real thing we have control of in this world is how we choose to respond. So when we are in these situations, you've got to take that ownership on board, and then you've got to face those emotions, knowing that there's highly likely fear that's driving it at that point in time. And then you've got to get out of your head and realize that not everything is about us. Not everything is about us. So what is the purpose of the situation that you're in? So if it is change or if it is a difficult conversation, you know, what is the value? Like, the value for the change might not be directly for you, but it might be for your customers. It might be for the people around you. The difficult conversation is not about you either. It's about getting the right outcome for the person and you that are involved in that interaction. And then it's getting that ask at that communication to make sure that you're actually engaging your logical brain and you're not just being guided through an emotional brain, through an emotional hijack, through your conversations and your communications. And then your drive is being able to flick over from that, you know, stuck in the problem situation to actually moving into solution mode.
Great, great information. Let's change the topic a little bit, please, Amy. Talk to us about building your practice in your business. How did you get started as independent and become so successful, get your clients, get the companies of Australia to know the services you provide? Tell us the entrepreneurial history, please.
Sure. My background is actually corporate world. So I was in corporate for over 19 years in insurance predominantly, and absolutely loved the interaction with people. And I think, you know, that obviously is a common thread that goes through all of my work. It's understanding that, you know, people is what makes the world go round, right? So being in that insurance corporate environment, I found it fascinating just looking at the difference in the workplace or in businesses and organizations that your competitors will easily copy your products and it won't take them very long to copy your products. But it's the people that you have within your organization that is your key differentiator. So when I started to really look into those people, I started to do a lot of work in that corporate environment to be able to help different pockets of organizations where they were underperforming or their market share was low or they weren't getting the financial returns that they were expecting, and starting to help people to understand their purpose and understand their emotional intelligence, knowing that your emotional intelligence will increase your performance to a much higher level. So that was where I kind of started. And then I got to the point where seeing the difference it made in the corporate world, I thought, how can I help more people? How can we get this emotional intelligence on the table in the conversation so that, you know, organizations and businesses aren't just looking at that bottom line, they're understanding that success is going to come through your products and your services, but it's also going to come through the how and why, the people. So it was at that point, Jim, that I thought, you know what, I'm gonna believe in the one thing I've got control over in this world, and that's me. So I set up my business, and coming from the corporate background, I'm a big believer in business plans, having a detailed business plan and having the structure behind you. And my approach was just to get out and just speak to as many people as you possibly can, to make a difference, to know that, you know, the reason why I set up my business wasn't to get rich, right? Like it being an employee in corporate, I was quite happy with that. But when you start to get driven by a passion in your organization or in your new business that you're starting up, it gives you a completely different drive. So it gave me that drive to really meet as many people as I possibly can. It was saying yes to every coffee catch-up request. It was making sure that every month I had, you know, I targeted different industries and different people. And it wasn't about me selling. It was about me understanding that industry, understanding their biggest challenges and being able to share just that, even upfront, just that bit of information that could potentially help them to show the difference that it could make. And I think if you really work on those connections and those relationships with your future clients and just with the people around you, the business will naturally grow. It'll naturally grow to that point that sales and marketing isn't really something that you have to focus too hard on, because that word of mouth and the return customers and the results start to prove themselves.
And has the word of mouth then been your primary marketing and advertising tool?
Yeah, so word of mouth and return customers are my number one. Second to that is LinkedIn. The LinkedIn platform is incredible, and I think it's made networking these days a lot easier, that you can network with people at any time across the world, and my website as well. So your website is always going to be important to get your SEO up and make sure that people can find you, because you can have, I mean, you can have the best product, you can have the best service in the world, but if no one knows you exist, it's not going to do you any good, is it?
Very true. Where can we go and take an emotional intelligence test and get started?
Yes, so you can actually do an emotional intelligence test in my first book and also through my website as well. So if you head onto my website, which is amyjacobson.com.au, there will be references there to be able to do your emotional intelligence test, or as I said, it's in my first book. But if you're super interested, and I truly do mean it, Jim, I love meeting new people. So reach out to me. Reach out to me through the LinkedIn platform, through my website, anywhere, and I would be more than happy to work with you and get you started on how to have a look at your current levels of emotional intelligence and how to develop them further.
Fantastic. Amy, great stuff. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'd love to have you back. Thanks a lot. Congratulations on the book. I hope it sells well.
Bye. Thanks, Jim. It was my absolute pleasure.
And we'll be right back.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh my gosh, I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one. You know, that is a phenomenal question.
That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question. And that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
We are back and very excited that you are with us. Thank you so very much. I am honored and excited to introduce you to my first guest today. He is one of those people that you just don't need to introduce. Scott Turow is the author of 11 bestsellers. His breakthrough book, Presumed Innocent, was, of course, made into an incredible Harrison Ford movie and just one of the best books that I've ever read. Just loved it. Legal thrillers. And the lawyer from that book,
Sandy Stern.
Thank you. Sandy Stern is still with us and appears in the 11th book in sort of a series called The Last Trial. He comes out of retirement. Scott's books have sold 30 million copies around the world, and he is still a practicing attorney doing international white collar legal work. Scott, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Jim. Thanks. I'm having one of those dream days for a novelist. The Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, and the Washington Post all say I've written a really good book. So doesn't happen all that often, so I'm enjoying it.
Well, congratulations. Well-deserved. You were in creative writing before you became an attorney and sold your soul. Is that correct?
Exactly. Before I went to the dark side, I was living in the land of light. My dream has always been, or was always, to be a novelist. And that led me to become a writing fellow at Stanford after I finished college. And then I taught there. They have these little lectureships in the English department to continue to support young writers. And typically for most of my colleagues who took those jobs, it ends up being the stepping stone to an academic career. And that's a good way for a writer to support her or himself, assuming that, bestsellerdom has not come to them. And I was headed for an academic career, and I didn't feel inspired by that possibility. And I began to look around and say, what am I really interested in? And to my real shock, I was most fascinated by what my friends were doing who practiced criminal law, whether as prosecutors or as defense lawyers. And after a lot of soul searching and uncertainty, because I knew it was going to be hard to write if I became a lawyer, I decided that, I would do it anyway and try to figure out a way to, have my cake and eat it too, be a lawyer and be a writer. And lo and behold, that's what happened.
Well, you did get the cake and eat it too. Congratulations on that. And that is something that we really like on this show. So kudos. Were you able to write through law school, or was that just impossible with all the 1L requirements and all of that?
No, as a matter of fact, Jim, whether you are aware of it or not, the fact that you use the word 1L may be the only real contribution I've made to the English language. When I decided to go to law school, I was embarrassed and wrote a letter to my agent and said, I'm going to go to law school, but I plan to continue to be a writer. And I got about halfway through this letter, and I thought, man, this sounds really lame. And so I added as a kind of afterthought, but nobody's ever written a book about what it was like to be a law student. And she showed that letter to an editor. And before I'd set foot in law school, I had a book contract to write about my experiences as a law student. And it's now more than 40 years later. And that book, called auspiciously 1L, is still in print. It was, my real entry point into the literary world. And although it was 10 years later that Presumed Innocent came, I always say that the great break of my in my literary life was going to law school. And that really is true. So 1L was the first book. And of course, I wrote it while I was in law school. So I was able to, begin having the two lives right from the beginning.
But were you able to take your studies seriously, knowing that, I'm probably going to make it as a novelist now? I've already got a deal, and I can just do this law stuff now just to get educated enough so that I can speak the genre. And after I should, just coast on through school.
Sling the lingo. No, I was kind of desperately afraid of relying on literary success. I'd already seen a lot of people kind of come and go. And I also didn't have a great deal of faith in, the judgment process in the publishing world. So, although many people find this hard to believe, I had actually taken my own measure very well. And I found the law as a subject. I didn't always enjoy law school, but I found the law itself really, really interesting. And I wanted to practice. I was really engaged in studying law, sometimes a high anxiety undertaking for the law student. But I always had my eye on practice, even after 1L came out in my third year as a law student and, you know, did well. I really was too snake bit about the way the publishing world worked to count on that. And even after Presumed Innocent, you know, became this incredible shooting star, you know, across the American skies, I still didn't want to give up practicing law. Part of it was, by then, I felt if it ain't broke, don't fix it. If I can write, you know, a book that was number one around the world while practicing law, then why should I quit practicing law? But beyond that, I like law. I think it's really interesting. I don't think I've ever had a legal case that actually bored me. Now, you would be bored if I started telling you about, you know, some of the insurance cases that I've handled. And but to me, when it comes to law, there's always something that's incredibly interesting.
And what does the judge think, say, when, or even worse, the poor defendant on the other side, when they realize that they're going against not only you, but Sandy Stearns in the courtroom too? you know, it's just not fair, Scott, you know?
I have to tell you, Jim.
It's like, I'm going to bring Clint Eastwood to my high school after school fist fight, you know?
Yeah. You know, the truth is that, you know, I think I was and am a pretty decent lawyer, but Sandy Stern's a great deal better than I am. And, you know, there in the last trial, there are a couple of really high point cross-examinations in the second half of the book. And, you know, my lawyer friends who've read advanced copies of the last trial kid me about it, because they point out that Sandy Stern's a much better cross-examiner than I ever was. And I say to them, well, cross is a whole lot easier when you not only get to ask the questions, but you also get to make up the answers. So, you know, my experience practicing as after the success, particularly of Presumed Innocent, but even before that with 1L, is that, you know, most people don't really care. They're interested in, whether we're talking about clients or opposing counsel or judges, they are just interested in the case at hand. Every now and then, I've had problems. Occasionally, lawyer on the other side who thinks that, you know, my scalp would be a particularly attractive addition to their trophy case. And with more regularity, judges who are accustomed to being the big show in their own courtrooms and are irritated when they're irritated when somebody who's
they're not the star anymore.
Right. They get irritated about it. And, you know, my last criminal case several years ago, and I tried a case with my friend Mark Plessner, who is now the corporation counsel of the city of Chicago, but he's a great lawyer. But he was just laughing because he was down in the cafeteria and was listening, and people were saying, you know, did you know that Scott Turow and his legal team are trying a case up in Judge Crane's courtroom? And he was like, he said, I thought I was co-first chair on this case. Now I find I'm just, you know, your bag carrier.
Part of the team,
right. So anyway, it generally speaking, it's gone very well for me. And you have to bear in mind that I practiced law in Chicago, which is where I came of age as a lawyer, as an assistant U.S. attorney in Chicago, and then a defense lawyer with the firm of Dentons. And, you know, most people who I come up against have known me in that world. And so they they think of me that way first, rather than, you know, whoever the guy is who's, you know, airbrushed photos are on the display in the airport, you know, bookstore. So, you know,
have you been recognized in the airport and things like that? Because, Scott, I've known your name for 25 years. I've read half of your books, probably. I had no clue what you looked like.
Yeah, and I
I'm a fan. You know, I'm a fan, but I had no clue.
Yeah, and I don't. It's rare for me to get recognized.
Well, you're a lot more attractive than I thought you were going to be. Let me say that.
It's what my wife tells me too. when I'm back in the Chicago area where I've always lived, and people know that I'm around, and you know the folks were kind enough to care about my books, I'll be at the grocery store and I'll get approached fairly often. And by that I don't mean 10 times a day. I mean, you know, a couple times a month. When I'm walking through an airport, it's more unusual. Every now and then, you know, somebody will recognize me and say something nice, but, you know, it's not like being a movie star. I remember once I was sitting having dinner with a producer and director who ultimately bought the screen rights to one of my books, and I just had gone through this whole speech that, you know, it's nice being at home and people recognize you, but it's not like being a movie star. And I hadn't finished speaking the words, and some young woman came up with a piece of paper to ask for my autograph. And I swear to you, it wasn't a setup. And Mike and I, the director, producer, we spent a lot of time laughing about that afterwards, because generally speaking, I'm able to live my life in great obscurity.
All right. Where do you go to find your creativity? How do you get new ideas? Do you steal from the world around you the way that you can see, say, on Law and Order? You watch Law and Order, you can pretty much find the headline that they stole the episode from.
Right.
You know,
right.
Talk to me about your creativity, Scott, and in particular when you find it's gone on vacation.
Yeah. Well, there are many topics comprehended there, but let's just explain, for example, with The Last Trial. Sandy Stern first appeared as Rusty Savage's defense lawyer in Presumed Innocent. He was played in the movie by Raul Julia.
Just amazing, too, by the way. I love Harrison Ford, and I love John Spencer, but Raul stole that movie.
Yeah, Raul was a great actor. And, I love Sandy Stern. There's you know, the today's review in the New York Times talks about my obvious affection for the character. And, he's always been the first citizen of my imaginary world. And so he's always appeared, usually in the background, in subsequent novels. But, you know, The Burden of Proof, my second novel, which, you know, fortunately for me, sold like hotcakes, was number one on the Times list for 11 straight weeks. That was Stern's book, but that was 30 years ago. Most recently, about 10 years ago, I published a book called Innocent, which is a sequel to Presumed Innocent. And Stern, again, appears as the defense lawyer. And at that time, he has been diagnosed with advanced lung cancer and tries the case with a face ravaged by a rash that's an adverse reaction to one of the chemotherapies he's taking.
Well, that sounds pretty yucky.
Yeah, and so readers wrote to me and said, You know, please don't say Sandy Stern is dying. You know, we love Sandy Stern. Please don't say he's dying. And I responded to the first of these messages just instinctively and said, no, he's not dead yet. But that got me thinking eventually, well, how is it that somebody with, you know, stage 4 metastatic non-small cell lung cancer can live for a long period of time? And I said to myself, well, there must be, you know, maybe he's been lucky and he got into a clinical trial for some drug that's very promising and works. And that actually became the sort of jumping off place for my imagination for the last trial. I imagined that there was such a drug that has kept Stern alive, and he is defending the, you know, inventor of that drug, an old friend of his named Kirill Pafko, a prominent cancer researcher who's won the Nobel Prize in medicine. And he is accused of securing the permission to market the drug from the Federal Drug Administration by way of fraud. The medication's amazing, but a significant number of people who take it about a year along develop an acute allergic reaction that kills them. And quite by accident, I found myself in the middle of issues that people are thinking a lot about in the COVID-19.
Yeah, era. That's what I was thinking as you described it. Sounds like you wrote the book yesterday.
Yeah, well, again, timing, you know, timing is everything. And, you know, it's fortunate for me that there's an issue at the heart of the book that people will may be interested in for reasons beyond, you know, just looking for a good page turner. But, you know,
that's what this summer needs, Scott, is some escapism. Well,
happy to be the man, but you know, and happy to provide the excuse. But it's you know my goal always, and Aristotle once said that the purpose of art is to enlighten and to entertain. And you know, if I'm doing some enlightening along the way about serious issues like, you know, pharmaceutical testing, That's fine, but my number one goal is to tell a good story that people will find gripping and that will make them eager to turn to the next page. So, and I'm glad that you know, the critics seem to universally agree that I succeeded this time.
All right, Scott, are you ready for the lightning round?
I'm ready, Jim.
All right, very quick answers. All right,
sir.
All right, your favorite legal movie that's not one of your stories?
Oh, favorite? I would say A Civil Action.
I don't know that one. What's that? Who's that? That
was actually a big hit.
Is that a Travolta?
Yes.
I think maybe I have seen that on cable.
Oh yeah, no, it's good. It's really good. If you haven't seen it, go watch it. It's a terrific movie. And what I like about it is that the lawyer whose name is based on a nonfiction book of the same name. Jan Schlickman is the lawyer's name. Is a little bit of a nutcase. He's involved in this toxic tort suit. And you know, he's just sort of an obsessive who refuses to give up on this case. And of course it the weaknesses in his personality end up becoming his strength. But that's a good movie.
Favorite real life over the top lawyer, for example, F. Lee Bailey or Dershowitz or one of those?
Well, I don't, let's see.
Remember, it's favorite real life, you know, over the top.
I have to say Johnny Cochran.
Johnny Cochran, good answer.
Yeah, because I thought, you know, in his own way, he was kind of a genius. He really was.
favorite star that you've met because of your career, your writing career?
Well, if you're talking about a really huge personal affection, my recently departed pal, Brian Dennehy, probably stands at the top.
He was a great actor.
He was just an enormous, he really was a giant in every way. He was a huge person physically, brilliant, just a brilliant man. I've heard director after director call him the smartest actor they ever worked with, and a person with just huge passions for life. And I was very, very lucky that I met him on the set of Presumed Innocent, and he remained my friend from that day until he passed on April 15th. So that's my somewhat heartbroken answer to that question.
Oh, that's a good one. He was fantastic. Favorite author working today, not you?
I think I have answered Cormac McCarthy. But I think, you know, he has not been writing much. I don't know what the issue is. So I'm going to transfer the mantle to my friend Ann Patchett. And I base this on just saying who has written one great book after another. And Ann writes both fiction and nonfiction, but starting with Bel Canto and the book I'm reading now, State of Wonder, and many stops in between. She has just produced one great book after another, and my hat is off to her. I think she's amazing.
Favorite fictional lawyer, Atticus Finch, Colonel Jessup.
I can't pick Sandy Stern, right? I can't pick my own character.
Can't pick your own. Goodness, no.
No. Favorite fictional lawyer? Well, there's all kinds of different measures for that.
Oh, yeah, you could go a lot of ways with that. You could go dirty, funny, you know, what was the guy?
I'm going to be a little hackneyed, though, and give it to Perry Mason. Because, you know, as a boy, I always did. I never liked it when my parents went out, and they went out every Saturday night. The one thing, though, that made Saturday night bearable to me was watching Perry Mason on CBS. And so, you know, it didn't dawn on me for a long time that how could Hamilton Berger keep getting reelected if he lost every case to Perry Mason? But I loved the Cat and Mouse, and eventually started reading the Earl Stanley Garner books as well, and enjoying those. So, you know, there have been more original creations among the lawyers, the legal lawyers. I gotta give the nod to Perry Mason.
Sure. I always wanted the last of one of these legal series shows, for example, Angela Lansbury, Murder, She Wrote. Mm-hmm. I wanted the finale of that to be, oops, we just found out she killed all of those people and framed every single one of them.
Well, that would be an unusual twist, you know, but, it wouldn't be unprecedented. There certainly are cops who've committed crimes in order to get credit for solving them.
Oh, yes.
So,
oh,
yeah. It would take it to one step beyond.
Favorite star that you write for in your head? This guy, I want blank to play this character.
I wrote a book called Ordinary Heroes. And it went round and round in Hollywood, never got bought, despite the fact that there were several people who wanted to buy it. And I always thought the part at the center of that book was perfect for George Clooney and then Natalie Portman as the male female lead.
That'd be a good pairing.
It would have been great. I know Clooney's people looked at the book. I don't know if it ever got into the hands of Natalie Portman's, though. But that was sort of my ideal casting for one of those books that got away.
All right. Final question, Scott, and then we will let you go. What character, now that you've met me, do you envision me playing in your next film?
Let's see now. Pimp, perhaps. There's an investment banker.
Ooh, slimy investment banker. Yeah,
no, he's described in the book as actually being kind of a very good-natured guy who's having a lot of fun as a witness, being on the witness stand, just enjoying the byplay in the courtroom, almost as if he were a spectator. So that sounds like fun. A good role for you, Jim.
That sounds fun. Yes. Well, when you are doing the auditions, let me know, and I will fly to Chicago or wherever it is and audition for. I think I have investment banker written all over me. I actually met Donna Corcoran. This is weird, Scott. I think the only person that's ever been on Shark Tank that didn't do a deal first on Shark Tank. Does that make sense?
I understand what you just said. I don't understand how that would happen.
Okay, it did, and I can explain that later. But Donna, is her name Donna Corcoran? That doesn't sound right.
I know Donna sounds right. I don't know the last name.
Corcoran is the last name, I'm sure, because Corcoran Real Estate. Anyway, she enjoyed calling me the Undertaker because I was wearing a suit and, you know, trying to be conservative and everything. So I think swarmy investment banker, half step away from Undertaker.
Well, again, this investment banker is not, you know, not swarmy, oily.
Just happy. He's just happy.
He's supposed to play against type and just finds everything amusing.
I find life to be hysterical. Scott, how do we find out more about you? Follow you online, and most importantly, get us a copy of The Last Trial.
Well, if you go to scottturow.com, scottturow.com, that'll tell you everything you need to know. So,
fantastic.
So that'll do it.
Scott, thank you so much for spending some time with us. I look forward to my audition call. I know you will have your thumb on the scales of whether I get the role or not.
Yeah, I will tell you one thing, Jim, that may disappoint you, but in the two instances that I can think of where friends of mine auditioned for films, film parts, it didn't work out for them. So,
yeah, but three's the charm, and, you know, you never know what's going to happen now. We're in a post-COVID world. Everything is different now, Scott.
Right. But that'll tell you how much influence the novelist has over the making of the film based on his book.
Oh, I'm going to win it on my own charm. I don't need your help.
All right.
My own charm will just shine on through.
All right. Well, you shine, my friend.
Oh, Scott, I need to put some powder on my forehead. Scott Turow, everybody, thank you so much, and we will be right back.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. I lied. We're out of time for today. Have a great one, everyone. Take care. Bye now.